Hey everybody,
Nikki Nellis.
Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, although it's just me, again, the foodie. I think we're just going to start calling the show Industry Night with Nikki Nellis because it sounds better and is probably just a better show. The only thing missing, obviously, is when my husband David is a part of this, and he is the Beast, is that there is a little bit more levity because he's got the comedy gene and I absolutely do not. But that's okay. We're here to talk about delicious things happening in and around the D.C. metro area. For those of you who don't know, I'm Nikki Nellis. I've been covering the D.C. food and wine scene for the last 15 years. Have another radio show called Foodie and the Beast that just celebrated its 10-year anniversary. And today I'm talking to you live from the fabulous Line Hotel on Full Service Radio in our little glass enclosed nerve center here. I'm very excited because I'm bringing on an old friend today. In fact, he was one of my original guests on Foodie and the Beast quite some years back, Philip Green. He has just published a new book called A Drinkable Feast, but I really need to tell you a little bit more about who and what he is. So I'm going to say his day job is he's an attorney, but his passion is cocktail history. Would that be accurate?
Close enough.
Yeah. Okay, let's fix that mic so it's in front of you correctly. Thank you. But it's really interesting because you've written several books and you just published your most recent one, which is about the glory days of Paris in the 1920s. But you really are one of the authorities of cocktail history in the United States, and you speak everywhere and you do fabulous demonstrations, and you're going to be doing one in studio today. Why don't we get a little bit of your background?
Well, I'm very lucky to have this sideline, I should mention, but I'm born and raised here in Washington, D.C. I was a history major in college, and I've always loved, you know, learning the history and folklore of different things. And living in New Orleans for law school, I went to Loyola University in New Orleans. You can't,
just what a great way to get your drinking education on, right?
And eating. You know, you can't help but soak up the food and drink culture down there. You know, what other cities have restaurants like Galatoire's and Commander's Palace and Brennan's and Arno's and Antoine's? And famous, iconic bars and drinks like the Sazerac and the Ramos Gin Fizz and the Vu Carré and the Hurricane.
I was going to say the Hurricane.
When it's made correctly, yeah.
Because right. It can be pretty bad when it's not.
It can be pretty bad. But, you know, living there in my early 20s, it was sort of like what Hemingway wrote about living in Paris in his 20s. It's a movable feast. It stays with you wherever you go. So,
sidebar.
Yes.
Your other book.
My other book.
A Movable Feast.
well, Hemingway's memoir was A Movable Feast.
Oh, sorry, right.
So this is the second book I've done where I play off of a Hemingway title. His book, To Have and Have Not, it took place in Key West and,
right.
and Cuba. My first book was To Have and Have Another,
right.
a Hemingway cocktail companion. So it's sort of a compendium of all the drinks found in his novels, short stories, letters, biographies, fishing logs, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
So that came out in 2012, and that's where we would have met the first time. But so living in New Orleans, I just soaked it all up and learned how to cook there, learned how to make drinks there, learned all about the history and the folklore and the, you know, the music, and found myself reading anything I can get my hands on from New Orleans. If it was fiction, if it was a Confederacy of Dunces, or, you know, old folklore, or the history books, the history of the city and the demographics, and you know, its founding by the French in 1718, and it was under Spanish rule, then the Louisiana Purchase, and the Battle of New Orleans in 1814, and the Civil War, and just a fascinating, fascinating city, including, as I mentioned, its food and drink culture. So,
mm-hmm.
10 years after I graduated, having read all this and feeling like I knew more about New Orleans than I did about my own hometown of Washington, D.C., it occurred to me, my grandmother was born there. Her name was Marie-Louise Dupré. She was born in 1892. And my wife and I just had our second child, and we named her Madeleine Dupré,
mm-hmm.
as an homage to my French Creole ancestry. And I thought, well, I really need to research my family tree a little bit better than just naming my daughter after our French ancestry. So researching my family tree, I discovered that my great-great-grandmother, her last name was Peychaud, P-E-Y-C-H-A-U-D. Bitters, exactly. So her cousin was Antoine Amédée Péchaud, who invented Péchaud's bitters. And according to the folklore of the day, he invented the cocktail.
Right, but you had no idea
I had no idea.
Was part of your family history?
When I lived in New Orleans from 1983 to 86, I'd never heard of a Sazerac. Because back then, Sazeracs were what our parents drank.
The culture.
No, in my mind, a cocktail was a gin and tonic and maybe the Bloody Mary served at Collins Hotel.
I think, now you can correct me because you're the cocktail historian, but in the 80s, I think people were, there was no cocktail culture.
No,
really.
You had poorly made margaritas and daiquiris. The old school drinks were still there, holding on for dear life. The old fashioned, the Manhattan, the martini, but the name martini became bastardized, so it could have chocolate in it, it could have,
And there was no dedication what was being put into it, right?
Well, little did I know, people like Dale DeGroff and Gary Regan and other stalwarts were keeping the craft alive. And, going into the 90s, people started to yearn for a well-made drink and the history and the folklore behind them. I mean, as a people, look how far we've come since the 80s. The craft beer, movement started in the mid-80s. We're drinking better wines. We're drinking better coffee. I mean, the coffee you're drinking right now or what they're making across the way. Wonder Bread was a staple. Tang,
No, I know.
I grew up thinking a wine came in a jug from California and it was called Hardy Burgundy.
My cocktail of choice in 1987 was called a Grape Crush, which was sugar, sugar, and sugar with a lot of alcohol. And I was 19, so that's why I drank that. But I just, even as I went to, finer bars, whether in the Four Seasons or the Ritz-Carlton in Boston or in New York, you went to these bars that were supposed to be some sort of place to order an appropriate cocktail. It wasn't really about the cocktail.
Right.
And I think you are, I know you're right when we talk about wine. It's really the late 80s, early 90s where like this resurgence of wine starts hitting the American population.
Our palate grew up across the board, and along with wanting to better taste, we also wanted more backstory. We wanted to know, about the Sazerac, about the history of the Vieux-Carré, about how a martini is authentically made, and drinks like the daiquiri and the margarita, we started getting back to fresh ingredients. Use a real lime, cut a lime in half. Don't use some bottled mix and bottom shelf triple sec or, that sort of thing.
I have to be honest. I mean, most people didn't even know what a real daiquiri was.
Right, they thought it was strawberry or banana,
Right, and they thought it was frozen and
Slurpee machine.
Sweet and, horrible. Like, I remember the first time I had a real daiquiri. I was like, oh, this is delicious. Yeah, I totally understand why people drank it, but it got bastardized.
Yep, absolutely. In my Manhattan book, I talk about how the old-fashioned was bastardized by adding like a giant wedge of orange and a store-bought horrible Dayglow red cherry and
Maraschino
mashing it all
cherry,
up.
Right.
Yeah. The daiquiri got bastardized, as you've talked about. These Slurpee machines that have no semblance of fresh anything, artificially flavored and sweetened.
Mm-hmm.
The martini used to just become a word that meant anything in that,
in that glass.
That glass.
Right.
The Manhattan actually held its ground. Now you might be drinking a Manhattan made with a year old vermouth, and that could be the downfall. But that was a drink that sort of held its ground. And
I'd like to back up just a little bit. So you've written several books. Let's give the order of the books that you wrote.
So 2012, I published To Have and Have Another, Hemingway mm-hmm. Cocktail Companion, Penguin, Tarcher Penguin. Sorry, mm-hmm. Penguin Perigee put that out. Then in 2016, I published The Manhattan, The Story of the First Modern Cocktail. It's sort of a love letter to vermouth, because vermouth came over across from Italy and later France in the middle of the 19th century and just revolutionized bartending. By the time the country's finest bartenders got their hands on vermouth in the, let's say, the 1870s and 80s, they were doing amazing things with it. They were putting it into all different types of drinks, and it sort of jump-started the whole cocktail, the golden age.
In the States?
In the States, yeah.
But, I think when people think of vermouth, they think of sort of a cheap screw top, lasts forever, it's on your bar, but you don't know why kind of thing.
It should be in your fridge, but
right.
Yeah. No, you're right.
That's
right.
My point, exactly.
No, vermouth in the 1880s, 90s, up to Prohibition, was sort of a rock star ingredient.
Okay.
And then Prohibition came along, and everybody forgot about it. Then we're in the 30s, where people are, it's legal to drink again. Then World War II happens, and we get into this sort of mass production consumer age where
everything gets ruined.
Exactly. Automats, you know, mm-hmm. that sort of idea of, you know, highballs were popular because they were so easy, scotch and soda or something like that. Mm-hmm. Not that there's anything wrong with that drink, but getting back to vermouth, it became stylish to say, I only want, just whisper vermouth over the, you know, my gin.
Right.
Well, dry martini originally meant dry gin, not Old Tom gin. It meant London dry gin and dry vermouth, not sweet vermouth. But people took the term dry and thought that it meant less and less and less and less vermouth. So vermouth sort of became this pariah.
Right, like
in
an
the cocktail
accent.
World. Yeah. And in fact, if you watch the movie Groundhog Day, which I love.
Me too.
He's trying to figure out, you know, how can he have Andie MacDowell fall in love with him? So he goes to the bar and she orders a sweet vermouth on the rocks with a twist. And he's like, he makes a face like, oh God, do I have to drink that tomorrow? You know, right. When I surprise her by having the same drink. I love that drink. And that's a delicious drink. Yet in 1997 or whenever that movie came out, no one wanted to drink sweet vermouth on the rocks with a twist. It was...
Well, wasn't that also because, and I'm jumping ahead of our conversation, but because of the product available?
Well,
there is good vermouth now. I mean,
oh, yeah.
I feel like, well, all right, I don't want to jump ahead, so I'm going to go back. You started talking about pre-prohibition in the States. What was the cocktail scene? Because that means so much to what's going on in your book, A Drinkable Feast. What was the cocktail scene here in the United States before Prohibition?
It was pretty amazing. I mean, if you look at the state of play from the very first cocktail book that we know of was published in 1862, right? The first full year of the Civil War. It's sort of a horrible time to be thinking about a craft cocktail book. But Jerry Thomas put out his book. And as the decades went on, you had Jerry Thomas putting out subsequent editions. You had Harry Johnson. You had all these amazing... It's kind of like today with the celebrity chefs and the celebrity bartenders. Mm-hmm. You had celebrity bartenders working in every city around the country and around the world, but especially in this country, New York City, San Francisco, New Orleans, and they were rock stars. And
isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Because it's not common knowledge that at that time period,
yeah,
there was this real drink revolution.
It was part of the Gilded Age. You know, mm-hmm. we had these amazing, magnificent hotels, and these palaces, these country clubs, these, you know, great opulence, and you had bartenders who dressed to the nines and made things, you know, made these amazing concoctions. And you had newspapers that just ate it up. They would write stories about the only William, his name was Schmidt, up in New York City. All the different bartenders, you know, at the Hoffman House or different places, these grand emporiums. And this guy's created a new drink, and the next day some other bartender's created a new drink. It just became something. You know, you open up an airline magazine now, or you're on the Amtrak,
it's
and
the
there's,
same thing,
there's a
right?
drink page, and it's the same thing.
But I'm sort of curious. So now I feel, not I feel, but hand in hand is the revolution in the spirits available on the market. You know, 20 years ago, there wasn't lots of local spirits. There weren't distilleries all over the place. So back in the late 1800s, were we seeing the same thing? Was there lots of local distilleries? Where were they getting the product from? Did that matter as much?
Yeah, you did have a lot of local you know, distilleries, and you also had a variety of bitters that we didn't have for much of the 20th century because Prohibition put a lot of them out of business. So you had a lot of variety, you know, from Stoughton's bitters to Boker's bitters to Peychaud's bitters, Angostura bitters, mm-hmm. You know, so many on the market. Only Peychaud's and Angostura really survived Prohibition. But yeah, you had this wide variety of product available to bartenders. Plus, as wave after wave of immigrants came in, like I mentioned with vermouth, they were bringing with them from the home country
their drinks,
their liqueurs, their bitter aperitifs mm-hmm. from Italy or from, you know, from Germany, places like that. You know, Irish whiskeys and you know. Yes, maybe a lot of them were more raw, but you did have a lot that were delectable. You know, the cognacs of France or the Armagnacs, things like that, Calvados.
Well, like all things, they all were a nation of immigrants and are what was brought over from the old country gets infused into the new country,
sure.
right?
Sure.
So whether there are restaurants that open or somebody starts working at a bar or working at a restaurant or however that happens.
Melting pot, right?
Right. That's exactly. How it's sort of the progression, the natural progression of things. Okay, so we have this heyday. And we have, is this where most of these, the Manhattan, these cocktails are created?
Yeah, the Manhattan is probably 1874 or 5 in that range. The first Martinez or Martini.
I'm just going to say for the record, there's going to be a test later, so everybody better write these down.
No, you're seeing the Martinis and the Martinezes and the Rob Roys of the world all in the 1880s, 1890s, because mm-hmm. that's when you had so many books coming out. In 1884 alone, you had three different books that mentioned the Manhattan for the first time.
Okay.
And then 3 years later, I think in Jerry Thomas's book or Harry Johnson's book, you had the Martinez and the Martini. It was still a sweeter drink, but you know the flag had been planted, I guess, of these classic iconic drinks that would survive, you know, the decades. And yeah, into the 20th century, you still had these great books being published, great new drinks being created. And now you're starting to see overseas in London and in Paris, especially in Madrid, also so-called American bars, because Americans are now growing up, sort of like I talked about us growing up now. Mm-hmm. People are traveling more. They have, you know, they have wealth from the industry and the industrial revolution, westward expansion, the railroads, etc. So Americans are trying to be like their European counterparts to travel the world, to go over to France and to Italy and to England. But it's expected of the great hotels in London and France that they should cater to these American travelers, so they have American bars. So they're
trying. Which really started, quite frankly, like Americans always think they should be catered to. It was a bad trend.
Well, it's like that Fawlty Towers episode where this ugly American wants a Waldorf salad or
right.
something like that. Yeah. So, but you know, give the people what they want. Mm-hmm. In Paris, you had American bars, but you also had, you know, the Parisians wanted to. They wanted to drink their wine and their vermouth and their quinquinas and their aperitif bitters. And so at the advent of the 1920s, and you start to see all these Americans, maybe I'm getting ahead of ourselves, but
that's okay.
You're starting to see American expatriates coming over to France and also Londoners, people coming down. You're having this sort of cross-pollination between, you know, the American bars where you can get what you got back at home, but oh, let's go to the cafe or the cabaret and drink like the locals do. So mm-hmm. those people visiting and deciding to live in Paris during the 1920s were had this wealth of options, local and imported.
Well, so when Prohibition started, and so you were telling me off air earlier, it's
January of 1920.
Right, so almost 100 years.
I know. Yeah.
And it's such a part of American history. It's such a big part of the lexicon. I mean, everybody sort of knows about it, but I don't know if they know the why of it and what it really did to a variety of businesses.
Yeah, it's been called a faith-based initiative. You know, you had the Methodists and the Baptists, and you had a lot of interests, the Anti-Saloon League, the Women's Temperance League.
Don't blame the women on this one. Come
no,
on.
No, with that particular...
I'm just joking.
I know. Well, you didn't have the vote yet, so...
Right.
You had a movement that it was evil, basically. It, mm-hmm. it was sort of the Old Testament way of looking at the world, like, let's get rid of this evil temptation and we'll all be better off, we'll all be better citizens. And it somehow passed through Congress, and President Wilson vetoed it, and they had enough votes to override the veto. So on January, I think, 18th, 1920, it went into effect. And it said, you know, it made it illegal to manufacture, sell, or transport. So if you were smart and you laid in a good supply, if you had a wine cellar or you know.
Right. You were allowed to have it in your house?
You were allowed to have what you already had.
Okay.
And there were also exceptions where you could brew beer at home, or people were buying raisins and trying to make wine at home, or buying grapes and trying to make wine at home and things like that. And of course you had stills and you had,
sure.
You had the bootleggers, and that's a whole nother topic. But yeah, I mean, Americans are resourceful and they didn't feel like they were breaking the law. They felt like something had been taken away from them, and they became scofflaws, which is a term that was coined as part of a word contest, and then within days a drink is invented called the scofflaw at Harry's New York Bar in Paris. Harry's New York Bar had their finger on the pulse of the American people throughout, they still do, and you know, they have straw polls on who's going to win the next presidential election. And they had four or five different cocktails sort of making fun of Prohibition. Like, why would you people across the pond do such a thing to yourselves? Come over here and
drink over here.
Yeah, we'll fix you up.
So as Prohibition happens, and now you have this, not a mass exodus, but you have a ton of people traveling to Paris, which sort of has this real Gilded Age, this real heyday in the 20s. And cocktails were an incredible component of that. Hemingway is there, the Fitzgeralds, you have all these people going over. What was it that they were bringing over, and how was Paris responding to that?
Well, it's tempting to think that they went there because they could drink, and it seems
simplistic.
It was on the list, of course, but
right.
Yeah, Paris was where you wanted to be.
I mean, it is Paris.
Sure, sure.
I want to go,
exactly.
And I don't have to drink there.
Exactly, but no, you were going there because it was the cultural and literary and artistic epicenter of the world in the early part of the 20th century. So you had, you know, Pablo Picasso and Salvador Dali and all these great painters and artists and all different media, you know, trying all different and new groundbreaking things. Filmmakers, photographers like Man Ray.
Mm-hmm.
You had, you know, the writers trying out experimental writing like James Joyce or Hemingway, sort of stripping down prose to very clean and lean expressions of words, trying to paint landscapes the way Cézanne did. You had great poets. You had musicians like George Gershwin went there to compose An American in Paris. Cole Porter was living there, and
right.
Some of his greatest works were composed there. It was just where you wanted to be, from
mm-hmm.
from poetry, Ezra Pound and Edna St. Vincent Millay, and the list goes on and on. I could spend the rest of our segment just talking about who was there.
Right.
But focusing on why people were there, it was because that's where you went. You
right.
know? And it helped that the cost of living was very cheap, especially like Hemingway. He was working for a Canadian newspaper, so he had Western dollars coming in that went a long way. So you could stay in an apartment for next to nothing. And even though it might cost you, you know, a few francs every day to heat your apartment, it was actually cheaper to spend the afternoon in the cafe nursing a drink, you know, a very low alcohol drink like vermouth and seltzer or the rose cocktail or something like that, because it was cheaper that way. And you could see people and exchange ideas, you know. So the cafe became this sort of, living room or reception hall, country store type
Which
of place.
Which has totally gone full circle, especially as we sit in the Line Hotel. This is exactly what
right.
their lobby is. This yeah. is where people meet. They can, I nurse my green tea for hours and
CNBC
sit and meet and
get
chat.
A little work done or not.
Everybody sits with their computer, but it's obviously there's a lot of inspiration that goes along with that. You meet people who are doing other things, whether it's in the food world or the cultural world or the fashion world, and you're able to collaborate or come up with good ideas or
exactly.
get inspired.
Exactly.
So it seems like it was a little bit of the same
yep.
past.
Yep. And each different cafe, and I talk about it in my book, had a different sort of clientele. You know, the a lot of the artists, the surrealists and the dadaists would go to a place called Café de Flore, which is on the Boulevard Saint-Germain. It's still there.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the political types the exiles from Russia. You know, the Russian Revolution was in 1917. A lot of the white Russians, the nobility, would go to the Café Rotonde on the Boulevard Montparnasse. Wannabe writers would also go there. Wannabe artists would go there. More serious writers like Hemingway might go down at the end of the block to the Closerie de Lilas. You know, and then if you were a night owl, you might go to the Café Select. You can get Welsh rarebit there, you know, at all hours. And, you know, these are the places where you went. If you wanted to listen to jazz music, you'd go up to Montmartre,
mm-hmm.
up on the hill. Or if you wanted to stay in Montparnasse, you'd go to the Jockey, you know, and Josephine Baker and all these amazing African-American jazz musicians who ordinarily could only play to their own people in Harlem, places like that, St. Louis, East St. Louis. You know, here they were able to come to Paris and play for white people and black people mixed, and it was no big deal. You know, we were still, you know,
we were still in the dark ages.
We were still in the dark
the
ages. And, you know, here in my hometown in Washington, D.C., we still had segregated bathrooms until just a few years before I was born. It's just unthinkable. But there you could have a interracial couple and nobody thought twice about it.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a break now because I feel like this is the perfect time to then segue we can make some cocktails. And I mean, this is an incredible book filled with cocktail recipes and really terrific stories. So I want to get into some of them that are in here. And the amount of research, to me, feels like...
Labor of love.
Yeah, I was going to say, it feels like an awful lot. So this is Nikki Nellis, Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. We're in the fabulous Lion Hotel, and we're going to be sipping cocktails from A Drinkable Feast with Philip Green when we return. Hey there, it's Nikki Nellis with Industry Night, Foodie and the Beast. We're live at the Lion Hotel right now, and I'm talking with Philip Green, who has a new book, one of his many, called A Drinkable Feast. It is a cocktail companion of 1920s Paris, and Philip Green is an incredible cocktail historian who really has done a tremendous amount of research about the cocktails that were being consumed during the 1920s in Paris, which really does sound like a wonderful time to be alive in Paris specifically, not in the States because you couldn't drink outside of your home. But you just put together while we were off air a cocktail. What did you make?
So this is the Jack Rose. It's a drink that was invented here in the U.S., probably in the first decade of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And it's a very simple three-part drink. You would make it with Laird's Applejack 86. That's how I'm making it today. Maybe an ounce and a half of that. Half an ounce of lime juice and maybe the same amount of grenadine. So real pomegranate grenadine.
Okay.
In Paris, at Harry's New York Bar, they made it a little bit more complicated. You started with
because they're French or because what do you think?
That's a good question, because they did this with a number of drinks where they made it just, they would add a little bit of gin or they'd add a little bit of triple sec or something like mm-hmm. that, Curacao. They just wanted to tweak, you know, a classic. So this is the Harry's New York Bar version of the Jack Rose. I'm adding to the traditional Jack Rose 3/4 ounce of Heyman's London Dry Gin, 3/4 ounce each of Dolan Sweet Vermouth and Dolan Dry Vermouth, and 3/4 ounce of freshly squeezed orange juice. So you're adding the Bronx cocktail to the Jack Rose, and you might think on paper this looks awful, but it's actually quite a good drink.
Okay, so this is the Jack Rose, and this is the one that was created in Harry's
created
Bar.
Harry's New York Bar on Cinq Rue d'Anneau in Paris. Mm-hmm. It's still there. They have my book behind the bar. So if you wander in.
They better, right? Yeah. Thank you. It's beautiful. So the Jack Rose was a longstanding drink.
Right. And it actually had to change its name right around the time of World War II. So in 1912, there was a gangland assassination. A guy named Bald Jack Rose was a mob figure up in New York City. And according to the story, he was put up to the act by a crooked cop. And the cop ended up going to the electric chair and Bald Jack Rose walked because he was a star witness.
Okay.
And because his name was Jack Rose, a lot of people didn't want to
order the drink. Is that Merlot after Sideways?
Exactly,
nobody wants to order Merlot?
Exactly. I can't use that word on the air, but yeah, exactly. For a while, the drink was called the Royal Smile, which is, I guess, Queen Elizabeth or something like that. And, mm-hmm. and eventually, it went back to being the Jack Rose. So in chapter 5, I think, of The Sun Also Rises, Jake Barnes is waiting for Brett Ashley to meet him at the Hotel Creon, and she stands him up. So he goes down to the bar and has a Jack Rose with George the barman. So I think that the drink he was drinking, because he was in Paris, because it was 1926, was probably this far more complicated drink. And I make the point that they had a very complicated relationship, and maybe this
is why it was so complicated.
It was complicated, you know, having this complicated version of the Jack Rose is sort of appropriate. You know,
well, so. I'd love to talk about the contents of your book, because it's clearly labor intensive when you look at the amount of recipes that you have in here, and then a beautiful story that goes with it, which I don't know if people understand that almost every cocktail has a story behind it.
You hope there's one. Yeah.
Right. And well, it looks like there's a lot here.
There's a lot here, but there could be so much more. And that's, see, we live in an age right now when you can just
Google everything.
There's a website, I can't pronounce it, but it's EUVS. It's a vintage cocktail book. Mm-hmm. And there's also Collectif, C-O-L-L-E-C-T-I-F, 1806.com. These are both repositories, online repositories of amazing bartending books. So
wow.
I could just go there and say, okay, what books were popular in 1920s Paris? And, you know.
And replicate it.
Just phone it in and, yeah.
Sure.
But I tried to find drinks that I saw elsewhere in people's memoirs, in people's mm-hmm. novels, short stories, newspaper stories, where there's a hook. There's some way of, okay, why would I talk about this drink? Ah, because it's what John Dos Passos and F. Scott Fitzgerald drank one night, blah, blah, blah. You know, in writing a book like this, you put your hands on everything you can find that's relevant. You know, mm-hmm. the vintage bartending books, the novels, memoirs, you know, everything that's been written about the 1920s in Paris, and you create these inventories. You know, this is everything I know about E.E. Cummings and what he drank, and this is Scott and Zelda, and this is Gertrude Stein, and, you know, everybody you can think of. So you have that inventory. Then you have an inventory of drinks, and then you have an inventory of venues, and then you just have to start weaving, and you decide, these are the 50 drinks I'm going to write about. What can I say about each one? And mm-hmm. if there might be a great drink that I don't really have any, I looked and looked and looked, I couldn't find anything interesting to say about it, so it didn't make the book. There's a drink in here that I really don't like, but it's got a really cool backstory. It's about Lindbergh's flight from New York to Paris in May of 1927. I'm really proud of how I wrote the story, but the drink, no thank you. You know, it's,
okay, well, let's hear a quick summary of that story, and what's the drink?
Well, there was a challenge put out by a wealthy financier who said, whoever can fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean in an airplane will win. I think it was $25,000.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of, actually, it was the first transatlantic flight period. So two Frenchmen took off from France and with their expectation of landing in New York, and they were lost somewhere off of Newfoundland. They, you know, presumed dead, and everyone mourned their loss because this was a great adventure.
Right.
And a few weeks later, Lindbergh, by himself, I think he had a cat with him, but he took off from the same airfield that these two were supposed to have landed, never made it, and he flies, and the whole world was abuzz. The newspapers were covering it when they learned that the plane had been sighted off of Ireland, because, you know, you want to fly the shortest direct, you know, route
distance,
across, then drop down. And then he was crossing the channel, and people are just, the buzz is building and building and building. And Harry Crosby and his wife, Caress, they had a publishing house. He was a poet. In his diary, it's this vivid picture of them driving out to the airport. And, you know, so Lindbergh finally comes across the channel. He can see Paris in the distance. He can see the Eiffel Tower. He flies a couple of times around the Eiffel Tower. People are going insane. And then he sees the airfield, but he sees hundreds of cars with their headlights on to sort of guide him to landing. And when he lands, I mean, he's purely on adrenaline because he'd been awake for how many hours? You can't just put it on autopilot and take a nap. So people are like ripping the canvas off of the airplane and pulling on his clothes. And the way Harry Crosby wrote it was he was the new Christ who'd landed. And, you know, he was a bird. And it's a pretty compelling story of how the French people, who had just lost two of their own aviators, still welcomed this American who'd come over, you know, in the other direction. And finally,
I just have to interrupt you to tell you that you're an incredible storyteller. No. I mean, I've read your words and I've interviewed you before, but you just made me feel like I was there.
It's a cool story.
It's a really cool story.
Well, the stories tell themselves, but
No, people can tell them poorly, trust me.
Thank you. But
so what was the cocktail?
Well, the cocktail is I think it's called the Spirit of St. Louis.
And which would make sense.
It's there's also one that was invented across the pond at the Savoy, but it's sort of like the Ramos Gin Fizz without, here it is. It's London Dry Gin, egg white, grenadine, and orange flower water. So it's kind of like the Ramos without the citrus. It's not a great drink. But,
the story. Are you an egg white? Do you not like egg whites in your drinks?
Oh, you know,
personally,
no. I like a pisco sour. I love a Ramos Gin Fizz. I've been told by enough people that, well, first of all, I'm probably gonna use pasteurized egg whites. But you know, if you just use a regular old raw egg, the gin or the pisco is probably gonna kill any bacteria
that might be
in there. So I've never, you know, shied away from an egg
white. No, I just
meant
as a personal taste. I was
curious. Yeah, it's frothy, you know, I don't drink many of them, but yeah, they're fine.
So. Okay, I was just curious. Well, that is a fascinating story. I'd like to, one of the things you start out with first in your book is absinthe.
Mm.
Why?
Alphabetically.
Right.
Yeah, that's easy. they're arranged alphabetically, but absinthe was still available in Paris, even though it was illegal. It's kind of like saying I could probably walk a few blocks and get a Cuban cigar here or find a bar that has a bottle of Havana Club. You know, it was outlawed circa 1912, 1915 in most countries around the world. It was sort of the first victim of this temperance movement because a lot of people demonized absinthe. Now, it's true that a lot of spirits were being labeled as absinthe when really they weren't. They were just like raw spirits. You know, you've heard about people buying moonshine and it ends up being wood alcohol and, you know, people get hurt.
Sick.
Yeah, sick and worse. There was a lot of inferior product being sold as absinthe, but the true absinthe, the Pernods of the world, these were made well and, you know, carefully, and they were safe. Sort of the way 151 rum is safe. You got to be careful with them.
Right.
They're high octane, but there's nothing inherently toxic about them. But there was a story of a French peasant who was drinking all day long, you know, cider and mead and I don't think it was mead, but, you know, brandy and beer. And he finishes his day of drinking by drinking absinthe, and then he goes home and he kills his family. So, of course, it was the absinthe that made him do it. And it was the poster child for we have to outlaw absinthe. But it was sort of a forbidden fruit. And Hemingway found it's called anise doloso, an anise. So absinthe, to be sold on the market, you had to take out the wormwood, and then it became something called anise, A-N-I-S-E. And there were some absinthe anises on the market, like anise doloso, that probably had the wormwood in it, and they just didn't tell anybody. So a lot of people, you know, it was sort of like this wink-wink insider knowledge thing. But eventually the law caught up with them and it was banned from the market. But you could still get sort of black market absinthe from Spain where they were still making it. And, you know, in one of the articles that I found, they said you can't buy it in a liquor store, but, you know, any bartender, you know, if he trusts you,
he'll pour
it for you. Yeah, that sort of thing. So, again, like the Cuban rum or the Cuban cigars, you just had to know where to get it and you could get it. And it's one of those things where you're not going to drink vast volumes of it. If you have a dripped absinthe, it's an ounce or two, mm-hmm. and it found its way into a lot of drinks, just, you know, a dash here and there, you know, so.
As an accent to cocktails.
Right, right.
And I'm also curious, because you have a whole section on champagne cocktails, and you would think in France, given their commitment to their champagnes, that that would be sort of unholy to add things to their wine.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, they might have used a Mousseux, you know, a sparkling wine, not from the Champagne region. Mm-hmm. But, I guess they felt like they wouldn't use a vintage champagne. They'd use a non-vintage champagne to make a drink. Like, you know, the French 75 didn't start out as a champagne drink. It was equal parts anise and applejack and gin, believe it or not. But by the late 1930s, you started to see it made the way we make it now with champagne and lemon juice and sugar and gin. Mm-hmm. And you had a lot of the champagne cocktail was sort of the house drink or one of the house drinks at the Paris Ritz, and it was a favorite of Colf Porter, favorite of Zelda and Scott. And I guess you take a good glass of champagne, you drop a sugar cube doused with bitters into it, and it makes for a lovely drink. And
well, it's pretty, that's for sure.
Yeah.
It's a very pretty cocktail. I also noticed that you had a lot of cocktails in here that I wouldn't have thought were like Bloody Marys, mimosas, cocktails of that nature. They just seem more current.
It does seem.
I didn't realize that they had such history.
Yeah, the Bloody Mary. You can't exclude the Bloody Mary from a book about 1920s Paris, because one of the plausible stories of the creation of the Bloody Mary, there was a bartender at Harry's New York Bar named Pete Petiot, and he allegedly started playing around with the vodka and tomato juice, and then when he moved to the States, he brought the idea with him and was working at the King Cole Bar at the St. Regis, and it sort of, you know, became full-flowered at that point. It was called the Red Snapper or the Bucket of Blood. They're different names, and there's a lot of folklore. But arguably, it was originally invented at Harry's New York Bar. The mimosa, I think it's pretty certain that it was invented at the Paris Ritz. It appears in the 1936 book by Frank Meyer, the head bartender at the Ritz, called The Artistry of Mixing Drinks. But he refers to it with two names, the mimosa, but also the champagne orange. And if you look at Harry Crosby's diary from 1923, he says, I was at the Ritz drinking champagne orangeade with I forget what her name was. He had so many women in his life. But
That's okay.
He would go there all the time to drink champagne orangeade. So a lot of people think that it was invented around 1925 at the Ritz. And I can show you, well, it was probably 1923 or earlier. Now, the Ritz didn't have a bar until 1921. Believe it or not, it opened in 1899, one of the grandest hotels. They didn't have a bar for 22 years.
Interesting.
Yeah, but they opened in 1921. And Frank Meyer was the head bartender there from 21 to, I think, 1947. Great tenure. He knew everybody in town. He, you know, could tell you stock tips. And he ran a counter-espionage ring against spying on the Germans during the German occupation in World War II. So quite a guy.
Sounds like it. Yeah. And I know your book is solely about Paris, but what did America lose during Prohibition?
We lost a lot of our best bartenders. You can see parallels to today. I mean, I think a lot of people were fed up with a country that could do the things that America was doing. And I don't want to talk about our president.
Politics, but, no, but if my husband was here, he would have joined you. I don't know. I'm with you.
No, there was one quote that, a country that would pass the 18th Amendment, who knows what else they'll do? And we were becoming bigoted. We were becoming just too stuffy and stifling and conservative. So if you were of an artistic bent and you didn't want to pursue the American dream and the middle class lifestyle, and you know, you wanted to get out. It just was becoming too Puritan and too, you know, cookie cutter. And yeah. You know, the Levitt towns hadn't been built yet, but it was that sort of mindset that, mm-hmm. you know, that every, it was like the movie Meet Me in St. Louis, you know, that prim and proper family, you know, it just people wanted to get away from that. So.
Well, and so, but then how did our cocktail, how would you say that cocktails then resurged back in the States? Because it really died.
Well, it died here, but it was sort of on life support elsewhere. It's like we sent the kids off to endure the war that we were fighting, and then when it was safe, they came back home. But yeah, it took a while, and you had a couple of obstacles. Prohibition ends, and you see cocktail books being written to remind people how to make drinks, and it's not just about what to do with inferior bathtub gin and things like that. It was let's try to remember the craft. But you know, the American whiskey industry was way behind because you have to age, you know, whiskey for several years. So you can't just start up. You know, you could make vodka right away. You can make, you know, a light rum right away. But if Americans had a taste for rye whiskey or bourbon whiskey,
they had to wait.
They had to wait, and then World War II happens, and the America's you know spirits industry has to divert a lot of the alcohol to the war effort. So,
sure.
So you had this 1-2 punch. No pun intended, but you had, you know, these two obstacles to, so you didn't get into the craft again. Gosh, you really didn't. I mean, the 50s right. were about highballs, and I guess you were drinking martinis, certainly, in Manhattan. I mean, you know, we all watched Mad Men and shows like that.
But there was no real dedication to any sort of craft at that time,
you did
right?
have people like David Embury, who wrote a book in 1948 about the craft of the cocktail. It was called The Fine Art of Mixing Drinks. So he was doing his part to remind people, this is how you drink. This is how a properly made drink is made. So, you know, he was sort of out there evangelizing, but the masses were going for the easier, you know, bottle of beer or the highball or, you know, whiskey on the rocks or things like that when they could finally get it again. And again, it wasn't until, I think, the late 80s into the 90s that we start to see the craft come back. So.
And in Paris or across Europe, did they maintain their dedication to the cocktail?
They did. So they had their own, you know, their own mixed drinks, and then they had, you know, what they would serve to the Americans and the American bars. But, yeah, the hour of the aperitif, you know, we would call happy hour. That was very important to them. If it was just a glass of wine or vermouth or a liqueur of some sort cut with seltzer water and a little juice, you know, these taller drinks that were lighter alcohol, something that wasn't going to impair you for the rest of the afternoon, just something to, you know, take the edge off and then go about your business and have a nice dinner or something like that.
Pre-Xanax. Yeah. It's all pre-Xanax.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that's part of their culture, same as in Italy, the whole idea of the spritz, you know, and you know, you're drinking for the experience of being around other people and looking at the sun setting and, you know, the remains of the day sort of a thing. It wasn't necessarily, you know, our mindset during Prohibition, let's get hammered. You know, let's break the law. Let's do something secretive.
Let's get drunk.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
No, that makes all the sense in the world. So going through your book, before we talk about all the places where people can buy it and also see you, because you do demonstrations, are you still a part of the Museum of the Cocktail?
So we merged with about 3 or 4 years ago, we merged with the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. So it's now sort of a component of the National Food and Beverage Institute in New Orleans. So I'm still on one of the boards. So I still have a hand in that. We're doing on December 17th, our 11th annual holiday cocktail seminar, where a portion of the proceeds will go to the Museum of the American Cocktail in New Orleans. But it's not part of my day-to-day.
Right.
You know, for 8-9 years, I was the treasurer, I was the vice president, I was one of the founders with Dale DeGroff and Jill DeGroff and that whole amazing...
You can name drop away. It's totally
Robert
cool.
Robert Hess, right. Ted Hay, Chris and Laura McMillan, Anastasia Miller, Jared Brown. I mean, amazing collection of people from 2004 to around 2012. You know, we were working side by side all the time, 2014, something like that. So I do occasional events for them, fundraising events for them, but it's no longer, I'm not on the active, you know, running of the operation. I'm doing for Smithsonian, I'm doing a champagne cocktails seminar where I'm going to be selling my book. That's Smithsonian Associates in the building, the underground building right next to the castle.
And when will that be?
That'll be the 10th of December, so a week from tonight. And then on the 13th, I'm doing a cocktail dinner based on the book. Susan Delbert is the amazing chef at the Fourth Estate restaurant at the National Press Club.
Right.
She's putting on this amazing cocktail dinner, and I'll get up every so often and interpret the drinks as they're coming out and do a few PowerPoint slides.
It must be fun to pair cocktails with a chef.
Is fun.
You know, because that was sort of a... culinary no-no probably prior to 2000, but with the growth of the culinary scene, people are really pairing cocktails with dinner or with meals.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been the type to, I want a nice glass of wine with dinner, but I enjoy doing cocktail dinners where a chef and a mixologist who work together, and I often defer to the chef, because, you know,
palate.
Exactly. I can make him or her a drink, and they'll say, oh, this will be perfect with the crab cake, or this will be perfect with the beef tenderloin, or something like that. I know what I like, but that doesn't mean I'm adept at matching. But I'm there to tell the stories and to make the drinks and that sort of thing. So, yeah, they're a lot of fun. But, yeah, a lot of people look down the nose at cocktail dinners, and they can be poorly done. I've seen a number of them, but they can be beautifully done at the same time.
Okay, so those are your two events coming up. Anything else?
January 28th, another Smithsonian event on the Rat Pack. So okay. I'll be co-presenting with Noah Rothbaum, who's my editor at the Daily Beast. So he and I will be in the same venue at the Smithsonian. So that should be a lot of fun. And, yeah, I'm hoping to get down to Asheville, North Carolina in March, and in the Florida Keys in March, and New Zealand in May. So there are a bunch of
well, you'll keep us posted.
Yes.
On all of that.
Exactly.
Well, I want to say that A Drinkable Feast, which is a cocktail companion to the 1920s Paris, is an excellent gift for the holidays.
Thank you.
If it were... For those cocktail aficionados that you have, maybe they're not making cocktails at home, or they love making cocktails at home, this would be great with, if you took a recipe, buy a couple of bottles or some glassware or a shaker, I think you can have a beautiful composed gift for the cocktail lover in your life. Or also a great hostess gift.
I think this and my Hemingway book are both books that appeal to a number of different camps. You know, if you were an English major, an English minor, as I was, or, you know, you're a big fan of Woody Allen's movie Midnight in Paris, you know, Owen Wilson had that taxi cab that came up the street. Well, this is the time machine that, you know, that you can buy for $18 on Amazon, and it'll take you back almost 100 years to Paris, and close your eyes and imagine that you're sitting on a cafe terrace with a rose cocktail or a champagne cocktail in front of you.
Or a Jack Rose.
Or a Jack
Rose. We drank in studio today.
Exactly.
Well, I do want to say it is more, obviously, than just a cocktail recipe book. The history in here is really rich and exciting. And for what you think you know about the cocktails you're drinking or the history of it, you really don't. It's a beautiful book.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Educational, but exciting. Not institutional at all. So I want to thank you so much for coming in studio today. This was always fun to chat with you. This is Nikki Nellis. It's Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. We've been talking to Philip Green for the show about A Drinkable Feast. Check it out at local bookstores like Politics and Prose and Amazon and probably Salt and Sundry. We're not sure, but we'll double check on that. Thanks so much for joining us today. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio.